Hey everybody, it's Pastor Brian Ross from Grace Life Bible Church in Grand Rapids, Michigan. I want to welcome you to this video. It's been a while since I've made a video, maybe a couple weeks, largely because my wife and I were celebrating our 25th wedding anniversary with a trip to Scotland. We spent a bit of time in London. Most of our trip was spent in Scotland, and I was able to observe a lot of interesting sights related to the history of King James and the King James Bible. I've been getting some requests from people at church, as well as just people I know online who have said, are you going to say anything about your trip? Are you going to share any of the stuff that you saw related to the Bible? And so what I've decided to do, instead of being like that creepy uncle that holds the entire church hostage to a slideshow that only, you know, two or three people maybe care about, I decided that I was going to make a video and share some things regarding the trip here online in this video. And if anyone is interested, they can watch it. If not, you know, feel free to disregard it. But I want to talk a little bit about the trip and some of the stuff that we saw and some of the significance of it and so forth. Now, I'm calling this in the footsteps of James 2025 Scotland trip. We were only in London for about a day and a half, one full day. And what I'm going to cover in this video is not in the chronological order that we saw things on the trip. I've constructed things sort of in the chronological order of what occurred in history that we saw on the trip. Okay. And most of these pictures, I would say 95% of them are pictures that I took myself. Some of them are pictures that I pulled offline, largely because some of my pictures had like people in them and stuff like that. And I wanted to get some clean pictures of some of the castles and some of the stuff that we saw. But the vast majority of these things are pictures that I took while we were on the trip. So to start with the chronological order of the life of James related to things that we saw on the trip, we start in Edinburgh Castle. This is a panoramic shot of Edinburgh Castle. This is one of the images that I pulled offline. Very big castle. I have to say it wasn't my favorite. Of the two that we visited, I much rather preferred Stirling Castle. It was smaller. There were less people around. I felt like it was more quaint and that it was a little bit more engaging even than I felt at Edinburgh Castle. There were tons of people around and it was difficult to take pictures and move about and see everything that we wanted to see. But in the Edinburgh Castle, this is the walkway into the castle. You can see here the crest. And then on this side of the entryway is a monument to William Wallace. And on this side is a monument to Robert the Bruce. Those of you who know anything about Scottish history or have seen the movie Braveheart, you'll know that these are significant figures in Scottish history. Here's a close-up. This is William Wallace. This is Robert the Bruce. They're on both sides of the entryway there as you walk in to the castle. Now, of significance, this is called the birthing room, and this is where King James was born on 19 of June, 1566. You can see this portrait here above the fireplace of King James, and then we have the crest of the King of Scotland up here with the two unicorns. We'll say more about that here shortly as we talk about some other things. So this is where James is born on the 19th of June, 1566. He does not stay here long. I'm not going to bore you with all the details regarding the history, but James's mom, Mary Queen of Scots, was not very popular and was moving around a lot. There was a lot of political intrigue and stuff like this in Scotland at the time. And very soon after James is born, they move to Stirling Castle. Okay. Now I'm going to just move this just for a minute. Here's Stirling Castle. Again, this is a panoramic shot. I pulled this one offline. And James is baptized in Stirling Castle on the 17th of December, 1566. Some of this information I'm pulling from the Stirling Castle guidebook, which I did pick up when we went there. There's a lot of interesting, fascinating information about in there regarding the history of the castle. But you'll see that by the end of the year, so if we go back here, James is born on the 19th of June, 1566, okay? By the end of the year, they've relocated to Stirling Castle, where he is baptized as a Roman Catholic, I might add, on the 17th of December, 1566. His mother was a Roman Catholic, and this was essentially the childhood residence of James until he was 13. So James spends his childhood at Stirling Castle for the majority of that time. Okay. So these are just some interesting pictures of Stirling Castle. This was by far my favorite site that we visited as far as overall. This is the entry into the castle. This is known as William Wallace Wall, where you enter into the castle. Immediately to the left of the entry is a beautiful garden named Queen Anne's Garden. Some of these shots are of that garden. You can see that the castle is very ornately decorated in the stonework, etc. And this is the oldest part of the castle, the west wall, I think this was, if I'm not mistaken, built in the 1300s, where you would pass through this gate into the castle. That was the oldest portion of the castle. These are some views. The castle is very high up, and you can see for miles. There's breathtaking views from the 360-degree views, basically of the entire surrounding countryside. Very easy to see why they would select this area for a castle. You could easily see any enemies or approaching armies coming, that kind of a thing. So the views are breathtaking. You can see great views of the Scottish countryside from the walls of Stirling Castle. Another interesting thing to me was how the castle is built like literally right on the edge of the cliff. So in my mind, I start thinking, you know, if you were going to attack this castle, this would just be exceedingly difficult. And that's obviously why they built it there, for its defense and protection. And then here's a view of the city of Stirling across to another monument across the way. Stirling, we spent more time in Stirling probably than we did anywhere else overall on the trip. In the castle, there are all of these unicorn crests, okay? So you can see it here, the unicorn crests, there's the lion. This is the crest of the King of Scotland. You can see it again here, and here again, the unicorn and the eagle. And so one of the things I learned about was the significance of the unicorn in Scottish history, okay? And I picked up this book here called The Unicorn Tapestries, and it is about a series of tapestries that are displayed in the castle that are remakes of what's in a museum in the city of New York, telling the story of the Scottish history of the story of the unicorn. Now, I'm not going to get into all the details about that in this video. I am thinking about possibly doing a video covering this because I think it's interesting. I may or may not do that. I did pick up the book on it in case I decide to go that route. Okay. So these crests are everywhere in Stirling Castle. And this is where I thought this was an interesting little piece as related to the King James Bible. Okay. After the table of contents page in the original 1611 contained an impression of the royal coat of arms. So this is the royal coat of arms here, and you'll notice that you have the lion here with the crown, and then you have the unicorn on the opposite side of the crest. So this is the coat of arms of James. And this is a quote from Gordon Campbell's book, Bible, published in the year 2011, but he says, a fine woodcut of the coat of arms of James I, underneath which is written Cum Privilegio Regia Majeste, that's Latin, for by the authority of the king. The royal coat of arms contains the motto of the royal family, God and my right, and the motto of the order, and so again this is in Latin, shame upon him who think evil of it. The shield is quartered in heraldic terms. The first and fourth quarters depict the third passant gradient lions of England. The second quarter depicts the rampant lion and the double treasury flurry, counter flurry, i.e. floral border. So that's talking about all this scrolling and floral border. And then it says, of Scotland, the harp in the third quarter represents Ireland. The support of the left, moving this, is the crowned lion of England. The upper on the right is the Scottish unicorn. The rose of England and the thistle of Scotland are beneath. So the rose of England, the thistle of Scotland down here, and the Scottish unicorn there. So I find it interesting that you find all of these unicorn crests throughout Stirling Castle. And then in the 1611, the printing, immediately after the title page, is this royal coat of arms. So I thought that was an interesting point that I wanted to just make, okay? So at Stirling Castle, there is a chapel. And this chapel, according to the guidebook, that you can pick up at Stirling Castle. This is built in 1594, and it's built for the birth of Henry Frederick. This is James's eldest son, and he is baptized in this chapel in 1594. So this is the chapel at Stirling Castle. This is a picture of the inside. You can see it's got a lot of ornate decoration, very tall ceiling, okay? And one of the really cool things when we were there, this was on a Saturday, is there was this choir that was brought in by the Historic Scotland group that runs and manages these historic sites to sing choral music in this chapel, and they're going to come up again here in a few minutes. And I just want to give you a sample of the way that this sounded in the chapel. So this is kind of cool. We just stumbled upon this. We stood for quite a while and listened to the choral singing. It was very cool as it filled the entire chapel. So just get a taste of that here if you would. So it was very haunting and majestic. I'm really glad that we were able to, have that to be part of the trip in that regard. The next part of the castle is the Great Hall. And this picture on the left is of the raftered ceiling. It's extremely impressive. It's massive. It's high. And there are about six of these massive fireplaces along the walls that would heat this in the winter. And at the front, they have a display there, and there you can see the King and Queen of Scotland in all their glory, celebrating their 25th wedding anniversary, sitting in the royal chairs of the Great Hall. So just a little bit of fun there, but I really enjoyed Stirling Castle. It was cool. This is where James spent the majority of his childhood, where he was reared. By the way, his mother was out of the picture. He's reared by guardians and tutors. Until he's 13, okay? I'm not going to bore you with all that history. We'll move on now. Down the street from Stirling Castle is the Church of the Holy Rood. This is the Church of Scotland, the Church of the Holy Rood, and this is a very significant church for what occurred here. Most notably, in this church in 1567, while he's like 13 months old, James VI, son of Mary, Queen of Scots, is crowned the King of Scotland. And John Knox, the famous reformer John Knox, preaches his sermon. And this all occurred here in this church just down the street from Stirling Castle called the Church of the Holy Rood. Here's some more signage, okay? The Church of the Holy Rood began in the early 15th century, so that'd be the 1400s. And still with its original oak roof beams, this is one of Scotland's finest medieval churches. Tradition says that King James IV, this would have been James's grandfather, may have helped masons build the later Eastern and during the 16th century. So talking about building different parts of the church. In 1567, the infant King James was crowned here, by which time the church was a reformed place of worship. So they were now no longer Catholic, but this church was being used as a Reformation, as a Reformed church, probably by the Presbyterians at that time, thus John Knox preaching James's coronation. Okay, so here's another picture of the church. Now, when you go inside, this is a massively impressive church, much more impressive even than the chapel at Stirling Castle. Massive stone pillars, stained glass windows. You can see the pulpit over here on the left. And here's where we encountered the same choir singing in the Church of the Holy Rood that we encountered at the chapel at Stirling Castle. They were much better in this church, particularly given its historical significance. Here we see again the unicorns in the brickwork, in the work over the windows, etc., in the Church of the Holy Rood, indicating the crown of Scotland. massive stained glass windows. There's some signage commemorating the coronation of James and some things about his mom and John Knox preaching the service in this particular church. So, again, very clearly marked signage to indicate the historical significance of this particular site. I'm not going to read all this to you. You could pause this and read it if you so choose. But the bottom line here is that this is a church of very, very much a significant historical mindset. Okay. Now, in the front of the church, on the floor, is this inscription. Here, on the 29th July, 1567, the infant son of Mary, Queen of Scots, was crowned James VI, King of Scots. And then there's a little insignia here that this was unveiled by Her Majesty the Queen. That would be Queen Elizabeth, who died in the recent past. And this inscription was put on Saturday, the 24th of May, 1997, I believe, is what it says. So let me just double check that here briefly. I want to make sure that I get that right on that date. So that is the exact spot where James is crowned King of Scotland on that date. So let me, here we go. Here it is. It is 1997. I was correct. So that placard and that inscription is unveiled in the Church of the Holy Rood on Saturday, the 24th of May, 1997, commemorating the very place where James was crowned King of Scots on the 29th of July, 1567. So John Knox preached the sermon. Again, John Knox is a reformer. He is part of the group of people that went to Geneva, Switzerland during the reign of Bloody Mary to escape persecution. He's involved in the translation of the Geneva Bible. In Edinburgh, we also visited the site that claims to be the house of John Knox. So I just threw that in here, allegedly, and I asked, is this where John Knox really lived? And the girl that was running the exhibit basically said, to the best of our knowledge, this is where he lived. So take that or leave that for what it's worth. But anyway, John Knox preached the sermon. Here's just a couple primary, couple documentations of that. The coronation of the young prince, James VI, took place at Stirling, the 24th of July, 1567. Knox, as here stated, preached on that occasion and took a place of the scriptures for the Book of the Kings. And here's another write-up on that. Mr. Knox preached and took a passage from the scriptures from the Book of the Kings, where Joash was crowned at a very young age as the subject of his sermon, which obviously makes sense since James is only 13 months old and is being crowned king. And so some ceremonies usually performed at the coronation of their princes were omitted and many were delayed. So this is a Protestant coronation. This is not a Catholic coronation. So that means they're going to include some different things. Those usually administered to the king of the realm at his coronation were carried out by the Earl of Morton and the Laird of Dun, Laird probably is the better pronunciation, on the prince's behalf. So very cool to be in the very church where James is crowned king at the age of 13 months old, sermon preached by John Knox. So they had a book table, and I had to see, what kind of Bible are they selling at this church of historical significance related to King James? And much to my surprise and enjoyment, they were selling the King James Bible, which I was extremely happy to see because it seems to me it would have been somewhat of a historical sacrilege for them to have been selling anything else in the very church where James was crowned King of Scotland. So that was very cool to see that. And here is another picture of the backside of the Church of the Holy Rood. Now, while we were there, we encountered the same choir. I filmed it again, and I want you to play this clip. Now, for me, this clip was much more impactful in this particular church, in this particular setting, knowing what happened in this church, and this historical significance of it, to hear the choir sing Again, we totally stumbled into all of this. None of this, we didn't know any of this was happening. And so we just sat back and enjoyed it. Here is the recording in the Church of the Holy Rood where James was crowned king. Was really cool. I got chills and goosebumps listening to that choir sing in that stone church, the way the music just echoed and reverberated off of the walls, etc., the grandeur of the whole thing. It was extremely cool and impressive, and that was one of my favorite days from the trip, bar none. They were all good, but that was probably the Stirling Castle day and the day that we discovered the Church of the Holy Rood and all that. It was a great day, very interesting day. Later in the trip, I reached out to this church, Burnt Island Parish Church, okay? And I looked at their website, and they said that you could request a tour. And so I sent an email, and we requested a tour. They answered back, and we got a tour from a nice elderly woman named Anne, who knew all about the history of the church. They opened the church up, and we got to tour it. Now, before I go too much farther, this church was built in 1592, and this church is unique for a few reasons. Number one, this is the first church that is built in Scotland post-Reformation, okay? There are churches that are older than this, but they were built in Scotland before the Reformation. So this is the first Reformation-era church that is built in Scotland. The other thing that's interesting about this is the shape of the church. The church is in a perfect square. It's not laid out like the church that I showed you with the Church of the Holy Rood, which is very, you know, rectangular and shaped with the cross where you have a narthex and the thing is shaped like a cross. The church, the Burnt Island Parish Church is very different architecturally. It's very different structurally. It's the first church that is built in Scotland after the Reformation. This church celebrated their 400th anniversary in 1992. This was a painting that was on the wood carving in the church. Okay. Now, why is this church significant? Here's just another picture of the front door. So, notice this map here. In 1601, James, while King of Scotland, this is before he becomes King of England, is going to preside over a meeting of the Scottish Kirk. Scottish Kirk is basically the Presbyterian Church in Scotland, okay? He's basically in Edinburgh, and they are going to meet up here in St. Andrews. And so James starts his journey to St. Andrews, and it's slightly unclear to me whether he had a riding accident, something happened, and James got injured, okay? And he could not make the rest of the journey to St. Andrews. So instead of James going all the way to St. Andrews, he calls the rest of the Church of Scotland, the rest of the officials of the Scottish Kirk, he calls them to meet him in Burnt Island. That is this little place right here. That is where the church is, Burnt Island Parish Church. And so in 1601, James presides over a meeting of the Scottish Kirk at this small church, Burnt Island Parish Church. Okay. Now, very quickly, the church architecturally is very interesting. Each family had a box in the church, like a pew with a door, and they would pay, and I'm getting all this from Anne, the tour guide, okay? They would pay money to the church for the privilege of having a box, and then that money would be used for the physical upkeep of the building. There were normal boxes. There were what I might say plush boxes for people who had more money, royalty, aristocracy, that kind of a thing. There were also some boxes that were large enough in this one here in the center for people to bring their dogs in. And these are all around the outside. So remember, this is a square church. So there's there's basically an entire squared off area that is full of these boxes, and they have a lower level and then they have a balcony level that matches that. Okay. This artwork commemorating the 400th anniversary of the church is in the inscription. It's an inscription that's written along the top of the balcony area. Okay. So very interesting church to be in just for those reasons alone. Okay. Now, this is the pulpit. This is not the original pulpit, obviously. You can see some of what I'm talking about. So here's a balcony. Here's a balcony. You can see, and this would go all the way around. There's a pipe organ here, interestingly enough, which was donated by Andrew Carnegie of American fame. Him and his wife were on a trip to Scotland, and they went to this church, and there was no instrumentation to sing. And so according to what I was told and what I also read online, Mrs. Carnegie said to Mr. Carnegie, these people need an organ. And so the Carnegies donated the money for the organ to the Burnt Island Church, and they put the organ in, and that's how they got an organ. But this part right here, just below the pulpit area, is where James would have sat to preside over the meeting of the Scottish Kirk. Okay? So remember, it's 1601. They're having this meeting in Burnt Island because James is injured. He can't make the journey all the way to St. Andrews, and so they're there with James. They come and meet James in Burnt Island. And it is in this church, in 1601, that as part of a meeting of the Scottish Kirk, the topic of revising the English Bible comes up. Okay? So here's a placard that is on the southwest stone pillar of the church. And notice right here, 1901. King James VI of Scotland called the General Assembly of the Kirk of Scotland to meet within these walls when the proposal for a new translation of the Bible, later to be known as the Authorized Version, was put before him. So James entertains the concept of a revised English Bible here in 1601 at Burnt Island Parish Church while he is simply King of Scotland before he becomes King of England. And then in the ceiling, okay, inscribed on the ceiling is this, 1601, Bible translation proposed at the assembly presided over by James VI. So at this meeting, James authorizes a revision of the English Bible while he is still just King of Scotland. Okay? And that is recorded historically in this book right here, The History of the Church of Scotland. This is by a guy named Spottiswood, I believe is how you would pronounce it, John Spottiswood. And he's recording this information. And notice right here, after this, a proposition was made for a new translation of the Bible, correcting of the Psalms and meter. His Majesty did urge it earnestly and with reason did persuade that the undertaking of the work, showing the necessity and the profit of it, and what a glory the performing thereof should bring to this church, speaking of the necessity, he did mention sundry escapes in the common translation, and made it seem that he was no less conversant in the scriptures than they whose profession it was. And when he came to speak of the Psalms, he did recite whole verses of the same, showing but the faults of the meter and the disparence of the text, I think is what that says. And it was the joy of all that were present to hear it, and bred not little admiration in the whole assembly, who, approving the motion, did recommend the translation to such of the brethren as were most skilled in the languages, and the revising of the Psalms, particularly Mr. Robert Pont, but noting as done in the one or the other, yet did not the king let this intention fall to the ground, but after his happy coming to the throne of England, set the most learned divines of the church a work for the translation of the Bible, which with great pains and the singular profit of the church they perfected. So here's Spottiswood recording what happened at this meeting of the Scottish Kirk in 1601 in Burnt Island Parish Church. So what ends up happening is, so James agrees to this proposal. He speaks to the proposal. He quotes verses. James had done his own translation work, and he basically approves of this. That's in 1601. 1602, 1603, basically nothing happens with this project that I can find recorded anywhere. It doesn't mean there's not something out there and I just haven't found it yet. I have looked. So in 1601, James approves this project. Nothing happens with it in 1602 or 1603. In 1603, his cousin, Queen Elizabeth, dies, and James then ascends to the throne of England. And then in 1604, in January, at the Hampton Court Conference, John Reynolds proposes the idea of a new translation to King James at Hampton Court, and James immediately signs on to the project, according to the extant witnesses of what happened at Hampton Court. And it's interesting that James does that because he had already decided to do something similar while King of Scotland in 1601. And that happened at the Burnt Island Parish Church. So it was awesome to be there and see that and hear that history. Okay, here's a couple other pictures. Here's another piece of artwork in the church commemorating 1601. So I'll just say this quickly. The Scots celebrated the 400th anniversary of the King James in 2001. Not 2011, because for them, that's when they think it occurred. The last thing I want to cover is, for me, the most exciting, and that is I got to go to Lambeth Palace Library, okay? And at Lambeth Palace Library, I got to see Manuscript 98, one of the three primary source work-in-progress documents that are known to exist at this time from the work of the King James translators. This was awesome for me. To do this. This was probably my singular favorite thing that I did on the trip. So I walked in, I requested to see the document. They took two forms of identification. I had to lock my backpack and all my personal items in a locker. I had to wait. They go up to get the materials at only certain times during the day. So I waited in this little like cafeteria room where the lockers were. They bring down the document, and they lay it in front of me in this reading room. So my wife and I, we were sitting basically right in this area here next to each other. They bring the document down, and they set it on a pillow. So you can see this is the pillow. This is the document, the Pauline and Catholic epistles. Okay. Oh, I almost forgot this. While we were sitting in the reading room here, my wife and I were sitting down here in this corner. Literally across the table from me, a lady came in and sat roughly in this area right here, and they brought down a massive folio book, okay, and laid it on a pillow in front of this other lady and opened it up. And I'm looking at this from across the table, and I'm looking at what this lady is looking at from across the table, and it's occurring to me that this lady is looking at a Gutenberg Bible. And that was pretty cool as well. To be that close to a Gutenberg Bible just right across the table from me kind of made me kick myself about I should have allotted more time and I should have requested to see more things, but such is life. I was able to see what I really came to Lambeth Palace Library to see. Maybe if I have the opportunity to ever go there in the future, I can see more things and plan ahead a little bit better in that regard. But I just wanted to make sure I threw this in here before I forgot about that. And here's the title page, an English translation of the epistles of the Apostle Paul, James, obviously 1st and 2nd Peter, 1st, 2nd, 3rd John, and Jude. That is what this document is. So this is a document that was created by the King James translators as they worked on, this is the second Westminster company that worked on the New Testament epistles. This is a work-in-progress document that they created. So this is more than 400 years old. This is the work of the translators, and I'm holding this in my hands looking at it, and it was quite overwhelming in the sense of just thinking through the history of what I was looking at, okay? Very fascinating. Here's some of what it looks like, and I'm taking all of this from released images on their website. I had to sign a waiver that I wouldn't share pictures and all this sort of thing. They'll send Interpol after you or something if you, break any of this. But the Epistle of Paul, the Apostle to the Romans, the first chapter, okay? So here's chapter 1, okay? You can see there's some skips. So there's no verse 2, there's no verse 6. So what this is a handwritten manuscript created by the King James translators as they are in the process of revising the bishop's Bible into what would ultimately be the King James Bible. That's what they're doing with this particular document, okay? And they're recording, and so this represents a stage of the work that is roughly about halfway through the process of revising the bishop's Bible into what would ultimately become the 1611 King James Bible. So this is a primary source, work in progress document where a scribe is recording what the translators think these readings should be at this stage in the process, okay? So we're going to zoom in on a couple examples here. So here's verse 1, okay? So here was the bishop's 1602 Bible. Paul, the servant of Jesus Christ, called to be an apostle, severed unto the gospel of God, okay? Now here's the manuscript 98, so that's this handwriting up here. Paul, notice they change the to a, so the servant becomes a servant. Paul, a servant of Jesus Christ, called to be an apostle, severed unto the gospel of God. So notice they basically, except for some punctuation and capitalization, they accept in the manuscript 98, they accept the bishop's reading with just a couple revisions, most notably the change of the to a, okay? And now here's what's ultimately in the 1611. Paul, a servant. So they accept that revision of a servant from the servant of Jesus Christ, called to be an apostle. Then notice the change here. Separated unto the gospel of God instead of severed unto the gospel of God. So manuscript 98 changes the, as in the bishop's Bible, to a before servant of God, as in the Geneva. So this represents a change to a Geneva reading. So the Geneva had Paul a servant. So they amend that, and the AV changes severed in manuscript 98 to separated as in the Reims. So the Reims Bible reads separated there in that particular verse. So you can see the changes being made to the text in real time recorded by the King James translators. Okay. Now here's verse 2. Manuscript 98 leaves it blank. Okay. Which he had promised afore, so this is what the bishops had in 1602, which he had promised afore by his prophets in the Holy Scriptures. Okay? The King James accepts that without revision. The only thing they do is they put brackets or parentheses around it, which he had promised afore by his prophets in the Holy Scriptures. This is the exact same reading which was in the Great Bible from 1539, which he had promised afore by his prophets in the Holy Scriptures. So it is unchanged. So manuscript 98 leaves it blank, indicating that they intend to accept the bishop's reading into the 1611 without revision. That's exactly what happened here in this example with Romans chapter 1 verse 2. So manuscript 98 is recording these decisions by the King James translators. We'll look at one more verse 3. The bishop said of his son, which was made of the seed of David after the flesh. The manuscript 98 reading changes that of his son, which was made of the seed of David according to the flesh. So after the flesh and the bishops becomes according to the flesh in manuscript 98. And then we see the King James 1611. They revise the front part of the verse further than what's recorded in manuscript 98 concerning his son, Jesus Christ, our Lord. That's from the Wit Church. That's from the Geneva New Testament 1557, which was made of the seed of David according to the flesh. So they, notice, they adopt the change in recorded in manuscript 98 according to the flesh, but they do further revision to the front part of the verse than what is recorded in manuscript 98. So manuscript 98 is a snapshot in time of the work of the King James translators. And you can take the Bishop's Bible, 1602, put manuscript 98 in the middle, and then put the 1611 on the other side, and you can track the changes that the translators are making to the text as they do their work of revising the bishop's Bible, okay? So, some interesting things here. The King James translators were working off the bishop's Bible as their base text. This is undeniable. Moreover, as they worked to revise the bishop's Bible according to rule number 1, they did so according to rule 14, which told them to look at the Tyndale, the Wit Church, the Geneva, etc. The translators compared the 1602 bishop's text against the original language, Greek, in the Romans example, as well as previous English versions, and amended the text accordingly. In places where the bishop's text was amended in Romans chapter 1, the revision statistics regarding the source of the alternative reading found in the AV are as follows. So they have Reims wording 19 times. That's a whole thing. But yes, they looked at the Reims. John Boyce records Reims examples in his notes from the general meeting at the end of the process. 17 changes to the Geneva, 16 are original to the King James translators, 6 from the Whittingham 1557 Geneva New Testament, 4 from Tyndale, and 3 from Coverdale or the Great Bible. Okay, so when you look at all of this, we can observe categories from Romans chapter 1. Category 1, the bishop's reading is accepted into the authorized version without any changes. That would be verse 2, verse 15, and verse 18 of Romans chapter 1. Category 2, the bishop's reading is accepted into manuscript 98 without any changes, but then amended in the AV. So this would mean that the bishop's reading is originally accepted without change into manuscript 98, but then further changes were made after that. That would be verse 6, verse 9, verse 8, verse 9, and verse 23 of Romans chapter 1, so that would be 4 verses. Category 3, bishop's reading is amended in manuscript 98 and accepted into the AV with no further changes. So that means the bishop's reading is changed in manuscript 98, and then it shows up in the 1611 exactly the way it was worded in manuscript 98. This would be verse 7, verse 17, verse 22, verse 28, and verse 31 of Romans chapter 1. So 5 verses. Category 4, the bishop's reading is amended in manuscript 98, and then further amended in the authorized version. This is 18 verses from Romans chapter 1. So that would mean they amend it in manuscript 98, and then they amend it again in the 1611 AV. And then a fifth category, this is bishop's reading is amended in manuscript 98 only to have some or all of the original bishop's reading reinstated in the AV. So they think better of the revisions recorded in manuscript 98, and they reinstate some or all of the bishop's reading. That's 2 verses in Romans 1, verses 14 through 20. So I was extremely excited to see this document because it allowed me to have my hands on something that I have been studying for a long time using other formats. Okay. So the manuscript 98 document essentially represents about half the changes, the halfway point between the Bishop's Bible and what would ultimately be the King James. The statistical evidence that one can extract from collating manuscript 98 with a 1602 Bishop's Bible and the 1611 AV speaks to the mind-boggling and tedious nature of the work. In the 1,769 verses that manuscript 98 writes out, there are 4,131 revisions of the Bishop's Bible. 3,000. So of this 4,131, 3,287 of these appear in the King James Bible, plus a further 1,765 revisions not marked in manuscript 98. All of this, when there are 2,782 verses in the New Testament epistles total. So, counting all of this up, okay, we could say this. So there are two stages. Each made a similar number of changes to their working text, 4,131 and 3,818. Of the 6,261 revisions that the King James Bible makes to the Bishop's Bible text of the epistles, just over half come from manuscript 98, 3,287 against 2,974. So manuscript 98 represents essentially the halfway point in the translation process used by the King James translators. While it seems impossible to ascertain from which of these two stages manuscript 98 was prepared, it is certain that the Westminster Company prepared a manuscript of its work at the halfway stage, and that the purpose of the manuscript was critical scrutiny of the work. Such scrutiny had been ordered by the rules furnished by the translators. So it is very possible that then the book was circulated to the other companies for them to look at. And I have talked about this in great detail in some videos that I will show you here in a minute. So finally, when I got home from going to Scotland, a friend of mine, Brother Christopher Yetzer in Italy, sent me a message on Facebook Messenger that Ward Allen's book, Translating the New Testament Epistles, a manuscript from King James Westminster Company, was on sale on eBay. This is a transcription of manuscript 98 that Ward Allen made in 1977, where he went to Lambeth Palace Library, he sat down with the document, and he collated all of it and published this book, extremely rare, hard-to-find book, and Christopher sent me a message about it, so I immediately bought it. It came in the mail. Here's the picture of the title page. Here's a picture of Ward Allen's title page. And it came 2 weeks to the day after I was in Lambeth Palace Library looking at the actual documents. So I can't say enough how awesome that was for me. And if you want more information on Manuscript 98, there's this playlist here. I'm going to put a link in the description of this video to this playlist. Manuscript 98, Lambeth Palace Library, King James Bible Primary Work in Progress Documents, where I talk about this document and show its significance to ascertaining and understanding what the King James translators did and how they did it. You're definitely going to want to check out that video. And then I also talk about Manuscript 98 in this video, The Making of the King James Bible. And this was my conference message from 2023 at the Grace School of Bible Summer Family Bible Conference. You'll want to check that video out as well if you want more information on Manuscript 98. So, all told, it was an amazing trip. I got to see a lot of interesting, historically significant sites as it relates to King James and his Bible. Hopefully you have found this interesting. And without any further delay, I will conclude. But great trip, great historical sites that we observed, and hopefully this video is interesting. I do encourage you, check out stuff about Manuscript 98. You're not going to be disappointed, especially if you want to understand the history of the translation and get a bird's eye view of what the translators themselves did and how they did it. If you've never trusted Jesus Christ, make sure you trust him today before it's everlasting too late. God loves you. Christ died for your sin. He rose again the third day, the victor over sin and death, and he wants to give you eternal life as a free gift. Trust Jesus Christ today. Stop relying on your works, your performance, your effort, whatever it is that you're trusting or relying on, and just believe that God loves you and that Christ died for your sins. Rely and trust in that. His death, his burial, his resurrection is the only total complete payment for your sin, and receive the free gift of eternal life today before it's everlasting too late. Thanks for your attention, and we'll see you next time.